Welcome back to the Daily Buzz from the 2015 Sundance Film Festival. I'm Dominic Mill, UK editor of We Got This Covered. We're moving on into our Hot Topics section at the moment. I'm joined by a variety of opinions and wonderful people. We have Dana Harris from IndieWire. How are you, Dana?
Fine and dandy, thank you very much.
We have Liz Ogilvy, a British compatriot. How are you, Liz, from Fandor?
Very well this morning, thanks.
We have Eric Davies from movies.com/Fandango. How are you, Eric?
I'm doing fantastic. Thanks for having me.
And on top of that, we have John, the wild man. And we are joined by Kim Voyner. How are you doing, Kim?
I'm great, thank you.
Let's just get started. Guys, what movies have you seen in the last 24 hours that really caught your eye? Give me some good ones to start off with. John, you look like you're ready to talk about something or other.
I saw The Diary of a Teenage Girl and Sleeping with Other People last night. And I do have something to say, but I want everybody to weigh in on their films first before I dig into this subject.
All right. Anyone go? Eric?
Yeah, Dope. Dope is a movie that I saw last night. I was at the premiere for it, and it was a very exciting film for me. I really loved it.
Heard great things about it.
Yeah, Dope. It's really great.
Brett Morgan's new doc on Kurt Cobain. Loved it.
Mm-hmm. I Am Michael.
That's the James Franco film.
Correct? Yes, that is the James Franco film.
I'm really sad that I missed that. Unfortunately, I'm a busy, busy guy who's busy with business.
Busy.
But
I stumbled upon a film yesterday when I got shut out of another film, which is my favorite way to find a good film at Sundance, actually, called The Second Mother. It's a film out of Brazil, which is also playing at Berlin. And it's excellent social commentary, but really funny about the relationship between a nanny and her wealthy employer and the nanny's daughter who she abandoned to become a nanny. It's fantastic, and it's written, directed, edited, and shot by women. Highly recommend.
It's always nice to give the chicks a
look. That's right.
I'm going to throw in Glassland, which I will be interviewing the director of for tomorrow's show. I believe it is tomorrow's show, which I saw last night. That was the first, you know, there's that Sundance experience where you go into a film and you're not really expecting much, or like you go in with like you got a mild interest in a couple of the cast members or the director or whatever, and you kind of go in there because you're like, oh, something. And I went in and I was blown away. It's absolutely amazing. It has this great sort of slant of poetic realism to it. It's got Jack Rayner, who I guess people on this side of the pond will most remember for his appearance as a very muscly man in the most recent Transformers film. But I know him from a great little independent Irish flick called What Richard Did, which came out a few years ago, which is excellent and absolutely amazing, amazing film. John?
You know, and I also wanted to give a shout out to, because I know it premiered last night here, it's It Follows, which I know you and I have seen earlier.
We have some bickering to do,
we have bickering to do on this film, because I'm a big fan of it. And I know you have issues with the third act.
Yes.
Which we will still throw down on. but that one opened last night, and I heard it went great.
I'm glad to hear it, because in spite of my issues with the third act, it is, I'd say, it's the first horror film that scared me in about 2 or 3 years. And David Robert Mitchell is a great filmmaker. His previous film, The Myth of the American Sleepover, warmed the cockles of my heart. My cockles were so very warm afterwards. And this is kind of like the twisted sister of The Myth of the American Sleepover.
As Woody Allen said, there's nothing like warm cockles.
Nothing like warm cockles. Anything anyone hated? I'm up for some cattiness.
Yeah, I wasn't crazy about Eli Roth's Knock Knock.
Oh, is that the Keanu Nununu film?
That was the Keanu Reeves film, you know, and it does some interesting things with the home invasion movie kind of start off with, and I was like, okay, this is fascinating, and then it just doesn't really do anything. There's no depth to it, and there's no sort of, without spoiling things, you don't find out the reasons for things, and it kind of bothered me, these kinds of movies where it's just like, let's just be crazy just for the hell of being crazy and not really give any kind of explanation or story behind it, and that sort of bothered me, especially when you have these two emerging female actresses as your villains who are so over the top and so crazy that you want to see a little bit more of the mythology behind their madness, and you don't get that, and that was very disappointing for me.
Any other vitriol? Sorry, John.
Well, at Sleeping with Other People, during the Q&A after the film, They talked about the fact that there are a few sex scenes in the film, and it does this time-honored thing that I think happens oftentimes with American films and notable stars in these films, where the women are having sex with a lot of clothes on. You know, and it's this thing that I think is particular to obviously the status of the actress involved, but particularly with American films and this thing of how they have to try to make excuses for why they do this and how they do this, and having, you know, directed a film that had you know, that sex scene in it, I find it really silly, this idea of you know, of trying to justify something.
Why we're having sex with our bras on?
Why you're having sex with your bras on?
Because women do that all the time.
All the time.
Sorry.
I'm wearing my bra right now.
To warm your cockles?
Got to keep them nice and toasty.
But it is. It's ridiculous. And, you know, and you have a film like Anne Zawiski's Homesick, which I think is a wonderful film, and there is nudity, but it's nudity that is based within the story, and you know, and it's something that does not draw you out of it and does not seem exploitive. I just find it absurd and just silly, that nonsense.
See, I don't know. In a super commercial movie like Sleeping with Other People, though, like, does it really pull you out of the film that much to not see, you know, Alison Brie?
I mean, not because I'm looking for the nudity, but it's just like, you just all of a sudden it's like, ah, yes, I'm watching a movie. You know, it's like, here's the bra, here's the very carefully placed sheet, and there's no moment of like, okay, I believe these people are really getting carried away with each other, because that just doesn't happen.
Exactly. You know, not to go TMI, but I know when I'm with my wife, and as soon as, you know, we finish having sex, immediately that sheet, that sheet goes immediately up, because the sex is over, and so she must cover herself up.
I want to ask you about Diary of a Teenage Girl, which I have not gotten to see it, but I'm a huge Phoebe Glockner fan. And I understand that there's actually a fair amount of nudity, and I've read the book many times, which is extremely graphic. How does that get handled?
You know, there is quite a bit of nudity, and it is handled wonderfully. I don't know how else to say, but that, you know, it is something that does not, you are completely involved in that girl's story. You're completely in her head. Because it's very artfully done, it is a very good example of how I think you should do it.
So I hate to be a rampant misogynist curmudgeon about it, but in Sleeping with Other People, we do not finally get to see Alison Brie's boobs.
No, you do not.
Oh, what a kicker!
Yeah, but as she assured us,
any male nudity?
As no,
no Jason,
Jason Sudeikis wieners, no.
But it is a funny movie, though. There are some really funny moments in it that I really liked. I thought, especially the dialogue, I thought it was really sharp and well written, and Jason Sudeikis and Alison Brie had terrific chemistry in the film, and so, you know, they called it, you know, When Harry Met Sally for A-holes, basically.
That's the sell on it.
And it's
on the poster,
and it has its orgasm scene, you know, from, you know, I think it does it really, really well, that scene, and it's one of the the most well written kind of sexual teasing scenes that I've seen in a while, and I thought Leslie Headland, just a terrific writer and a great emerging female comedic voice, I think.
It's interesting, though, to see the difference between that and The Overnight, which I think they're both well done, but I think the approaches to the comedy is actually interesting. You know, where you have, you know, The Overnight has this quirky off-center grounding, and I thought Sleeping with Other People had a more traditional kind of approach to the comedy, both effective.
Yeah.
But both very different.
Yeah, The Overnight is easy. The Overnight is the kind of movie where you watch it and you're like, you know what? I could have had that night last night when I went over to my neighbor's house. And I think that's what's really charming about it.
I don't know what kind
of
neighbors you have, Eric.
Well, you know, I mean, that's...
Eric has joined me on the TMI now.
You know, but that's the kind of movie it is. And I think that's where people, you know, where you'll watch Sleeping with Other People and you're like, okay, that's a standard studio comedy. I enjoyed it and that's it. You know, maybe I forget it the next day. The Overnight kind of sticks with you, especially when you're going over to the dinner party now at your neighbor's house and you're looking at your neighbor and they're like, okay.
I haven't really looked at your wife like that before.
what kind of night are we going to have?
Maybe after the spaghetti.
That's why I think people are really, you know, jiving with it, because it's really relatable, I think.
Yeah.
Any other vitriol? I've got some vitriol to throw down just very quickly.
Reversal, right, let's hear it, Dom.
Reversal's a pile of pants. very good-looking pile of pants. John is looking angrily at me because you told me you liked it yesterday, and I was looking forward to it, mm-hmm. and then I showed up, and the screenplay was absolutely appalling, and it made no sense.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Don't
I'm
agree
sorry,
at
which,
all.
Which film is this?
Reversal.
Reversal. Reversal. Which I've been confusing with Irreversible for the last couple of weeks.
Are you two going to have fisticuffs?
Before we've wrapped up the last episode of the show, at least one round of fisticuffs is going to go down. Okay, guys, so we got 1 minute left. In closing, someone recommend me a must-see film for the rest of the festival, starting with Eric.
Like I said before, you got to go see Dope. I just think it's a really exciting emerging voice, and it's just really cool. I think it's so well done how contemporary it is and how 90s it feels. And I'm a 90s hip-hop freak, and it opened with Naughty by Nature's Hip Hop Array, and I was sold from the minute go.
It's
so
like an amazing
song. Yeah, I say Dope, see Dope.
Yeah. Dana?
I'm going to say I Am Michael again, just because it's a really assured directorial debut by Justin Kelly, and it's an amazing portrait, real-life story of how a radical gay activist can become a married, ostensibly straight pastor in Wyoming.
Yeah. Liz?
Finders Keepers. I'm throwing a documentary in there. Clay Tweel and Brian Carberry. The executive producer is Seth Gordon, we know from King of Kong and Horrible Bosses. Mm. Awesome, bizarre story. Great film.
Oh, okay. So that's us wrapping up Hot Topics. I have been joined by Eric Davis from movies.com/Fandango, Liz Ogilvy from Fandor, and Dana Harris from IndieWire. Thanks for coming in, guys. This is The Daily Buzz on KCPW. I am Dominic Mill. I am now joined by the director of Dark Horse, Louise Osmond. Dark Horse is the inspirational true story of a group of friends from a working man's club who decide to take on the elite sport of kings and breed themselves a racehorse. I'm also joined by Anderson Lay and Kim Voyner. Kim, I'm going to throw it out to you first. Just fire away.
Hi, Louise. Thanks for coming in. I really enjoyed this film a lot, but I wonder if you could just kind of give a little bit more detail for our listeners who haven't had a chance to see it yet. This film is about a group of working class friends who pool in to breed a racehorse against all odds, and then...
Absolutely. I reckon it's a story that people around here would have a kind of recognition of, I guess. It's basically set in a quite a poor former mining valley where the pits have closed and there's not much work and times are tough. And the barmaid of the local club, her response to these circumstances is to decide that she's going to breed a racehorse in her back garden.
I loved her, too.
Not your everyday response to difficult times, but she basically gathers together her about 23 people from the village, and they all pay £10 a week, and her husband, who was a former nightclub bouncer who's missing his two front teeth and has tattoos all over, homemade tattoos, and who is called Daisy as a nickname, she persuades him to go and find her a mare. So they go and they manage to find this rough old racehorse for £300 that's never won a race in its life. I think came last in three races it ran and tried to kill every jockey that ever rode on it. Anyway, they get this mare, they find a stallion, and then they breed this little foal, this beautiful little foal, on the kind of common ground behind the houses with all the chickens and ducks. And it grows.
And it kind of like just grows up in a garden. And
totally. And all the local people come up and kind of feed it the leftovers when they cook their Sunday lunch and so forth. And as this foal grows up in the village, it just becomes the kind of centre of the community. And it's this kind of wonderful sight of, you know, it's the common ground is all rough. It's all wire and sheds and
rubbish.
It's
almost like he becomes a symbol of hope for this mining town where hard times have fallen on.
Totally. And I think, you know, to see a thoroughbred foal, they are the most beautiful, delicate, kind of leggy little animals. So to see this beautiful animal running around, you know, this little Welsh village, just fantastic. And as I say, he grows into this unlikely champion. You can imagine, to the horror of the kind of elite racing world who spend millions to breed horses, and here Jan's done it for kind of £10 a week.
I was going to say, it's kind of hilariously patronising to the sort of this idea of sports sciences that have sort of been gradually introduced over the second half of the 20th century, that like this whippersnapping up-and-comer who was brought up in people's back gardens has come and just taken down all this research and these millions of pounds being poured into these thoroughbreds.
absolutely. Sometimes they were at the track, and Dream Alliance, as the horse was called, would be lining up against horses that had cost like £80,000 and, you know, kind of bred from generations of winners. Yeah. And the wonderful thing is that the syndicate would turn up. They'd get a minibus with their kind of sandwiches and lager in their supermarket bags, and they'd turn up at the track. And at most racetracks, you've got the kind of stands and everything, but then you have the very sort of posh and exclusive owners and trainers lounge, which is usually guarded by stewards. And they had to let them through. They'd wave their owner's badge, and they'd be waved through, and there they would be amongst all these people in their kind of green tweed, you know, very British Downton Abbey types, and they would kind of sail in raucous and rabble. And it's just fantastic. It's a real kind of spirit of mischief in there, I think.
I mean, even the name, the syndicate, is so evil.
Yeah.
It's so funny. I mean, what I loved about this film is, and I noticed that before you came in, we had all our directors sign our poster, and then you sign your poster, you put Dark Horse on it, and you put Made in Wales. And, you know, from being American, you know, my window to Wales or Welsh cultures, a lot of mining towns, Doctor Who, Anthony Hopkins, you know, like
that's so not bad, is it? Yeah, Richard Burton,
yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, so
well done, Anderson.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Welsh people everywhere will be thanking you for that.
But you know, can you talk about, like, you know, also like with the heart of the Welsh people? It's like, you know, things that come to mind are plucky, they're resilient, and can you talk about? I mean, in a way, Dark Horse and Dream Alliance is the name of the horse, right? And it's very much a rocky story. And, you know, we talk about, you know, this horse being raised, you know, just in the back gardens on a hillside. You know, in a way, it's like the film addresses, like, you know, it's love or from the whole town, or is it just, you know, maybe organic? Versus, you know, it's like the, you know, Rocky IV. It's like, you know, it's like the Ivan Drago. It's like the you know, he's all pumped up with chemicals. Whereas Rocky, he's like on it, running up a hillside, you know. So can you talk about just I mean, my point is that, you know, this the fact that you put a sense of Welsh pride in it, and then talk about
absolutely
more about,
I mean, it's totally, you know, I have to say, if there are places in the world that you would want to go to make documentaries, mm-hmm. because some places have the gift of talking.
Yeah.
In Wales, they just talk beautifully, and they can, I mean, when we first went down there, when the producer Judith Dawson sort of made contact with the characters, we just couldn't believe it. And we would meet one after the other, and each of them would be able to talk in the most beautiful and emotional way.
Yeah.
And they're open, exactly. Yeah. And they just will talk for hours. They'll talk until you have to kind of, you know,
shut them up and drive,
drive away. But I think it's also, there's a thing, you know, there's a culture, because I guess things have always been a little bit tough in Wales, and maybe I would imagine it's not dissimilar here, is there's a very strong spirit of community. Mm-hmm. It's very, people look after each other. And, you know, so the horse, when he came along, and he's kind of an underdog, he's one of them, and at first it's the village and it's the syndicate, but as he starts to kind of grow, and particularly, you know, when he suffers, I shouldn't give too much away.
No.
Spoiler alert. I won't even say the spoiler alert. So what I would say is that the kind of the support for this horse just grows and grows and grows until towards the end of the film, when things are really hotting up, he has, I would say, all of Wales behind him, and it's kind of, he's become this great kind of symbol of, you know, of what you can do. There's no, you know, there are no limits.
And it's like a metaphor for me, it was a kind of a metaphor for the power of community kind of uprising against societal convention. You know, they, against the odds, just kind of shoved that aside, and that power of that love and support of the community pushed it through.
It's totally, and I think, you know, I think there's a tendency in this day and age when, you know, communities can feel forgotten. You know, when the industry's closed and there's no jobs around, I think people feel that they've been kind of cast aside. And you look within that community, and you've got people who have these extraordinary dreams, extraordinary talents. You know, Jan could be running a major company if she wanted to, but she cleans tills in Asda. But she's an amazingly talented and dedicated woman. And she said something really interesting when we were filming with her, which was, you know, when you're working class, people expect you in a strange way to have working class hobbies. She says, you know, people talk to you as if your hobbies should only be like darts or bingo. And she says, why can't my hobby be breeding a racehorse?
Right.
Why should that be the privilege of a judge or a lawyer or, you know, whatever, a kind of, you know.
And I love that it was a woman who came up with the idea too, and sold the whole village on it.
Totally, totally.
Without actually revealing that, you know, in her research, she didn't actually tell them that the last guy didn't make money at it. She kind of hid that little.
She did. She hid that from her husband. Definitely hid that one. But she's, you know, she's indomitable. She really is. She has a great, I think, where other people would have looked and seen, oh, you know, there'll be snobbery and people will try to shut us out, and all of which they encountered on their journey. But, you know, she just sees, in quite a mischievous way, I might add, she just saw challenges and thought, why not? Let's go for it. Who's to say we can't do it?
She's delightful.
Yeah, she's amazing. And the fantastic thing is she's doing it again. So.
Oh, really?
She is.
The sequel, Dark Horse, okay. The sequel.
Dark Horse 2, yes, we're lining up already to do for the sequel.
How's the documentary
sequel. Yeah. How's the town now today? I mean, is it a tourist attraction? Is it like really, I mean
well,
it's because of the you know, the legend of Dream Alliance in a way?
Well, we hope the documentary comes out, we hope it'll be on the tourist
right,
trail.
Right.
But I think one of the most touching things about the story, I guess, is that it kind of comes full circle, that mm-hmm. at the end of the film, you know, the characters, they're in the same place that they started, they're in the same jobs, you know, that they don't end up kind of
right.
Well, I shouldn't give away too much, but they, you know, it's kind of but the point is, it was, everything was about the emotional journey, you mm-hmm. know, they didn't seek anything mm-hmm. else from it, and they've got these fantastic memories, so they're, you know, they're all still in the same jobs. Jan still cleans the tills at Asda, but she's done this amazing thing, and none of them will ever forget it as long as they live, I think.
It's a lovely film.
It is lovely.
I think just, you know, just day three of the festival, I think so far this is the most heartwarming film in the festival so far. So, congratulations.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Louise,
thank you
for joining us. Louise's film is Dark Horse.
Thank you.
Thanks.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Daily Buzz from the 2015 Sundance Film Festival. I am Dominic Mill, and I am now joined by Crystal Moselle, director of The Wolfpack. Welcome, Crystal.
Thank you for having me.
Just to kick things off, I mean, when I read I must have read the IMDb synopsis for this. It doesn't sound like this could be a real thing. Yeah. Is it really real?
It's real.
How did you find these kids? I mean, sorry. I mean, I guess I should provide some outline for us. I'm kind of excited because this film really stuck out for me. It is the story of six teenage brothers and a sister who were essentially almost entrapped, I guess, locked, caged in this
more isolated.
Yeah, isolated in this Manhattan
caged
apartment.
Caged is a
by
negative
the...
word, Dominic.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, no, I mean they. Yeah,
sorry, I took negative.
Caged may fly in the UK, but not here.
Okay. Who were isolated in their apartment by their parents, specifically their father.
Yes.
And essentially lived their life vicariously through watching movies through Christopher Nolan, Quentin Tarantino, and the like. I mean, how did you find these kids?
I was walking down First Avenue in New York City, and they ran past me through the crowd, and something just was interesting about them, and I followed them. I literally ran out. I ran after them for some reason. I don't know why.
And your instinct?
Yeah, just something took over, and I ran after them, and I met up with them at a crosswalk, and I asked them where they're from, and they said Delancey Street, which is in the Lower East Side, and I said, no, there's no way you're from Delancey Street. I've never seen you guys before, because they just had something about them. I mean, they all, like, had long hair. They're all dressed the same, and they said, no, they were from Delancey Street, and then one of them said, what is it that you do for a living? I said, I'm a filmmaker. And they said, oh, we're interested in getting into the business of filmmaking. So I started giving them lessons, like camera lessons in the park, and we started a friendship. And that's how it all started. Yeah.
It's one of the rare occasions when we were let out, so to speak, right?
No, actually, there was a before and there was an after. So mm-hmm. there was something happened,
right,
which I don't want to talk about.
No spoilers.
Something happened that changed the dynamic in the family. So the power shifted, mm-hmm. and the kids were.
And you met these boys like right when that dynamic was shifting and that change was happening. It was a really fortuitous time.
Yeah,
right?
I met them like the first week that they started going out on their own. Yeah.
So I mean, it's interesting because, you know, they're. I raised in, like in Hare Krishnas, right? Like in the
no, they weren't Hare Krishnas. Their dad was influenced by Hare Krishna at a younger age, but they're raised and, you know, educated about all religions, and mm-hmm. you know, they're very smart. Their mother homeschooled them. I mean, they are
very articulate.
Very articulate. Extremely articulate, and
what's amazing, because, like, you know, the fact that they're, you know, isolated from, I guess, you know, from the rest of the world, but they're so, again, articulate and so charismatic, you know, and making these home movies. I mean, almost shot for shot remakes of all these movies that they love. And
yeah,
they're great.
Yeah, they're making their own props. They're little artists. They do these reenactments of films, and where they'll, like, you know, build costumes from yoga mats and cereal boxes. They're very resourceful. You know, their dad would bring them stuff home to like build things out of, and you know, that became their expression and their way of coping and like building these other worlds.
Well, and it is, and you almost, until you sit there and watch the film, you almost can't describe how amazing their little personal production design and art direction is for their productions. I mean, it is remarkable.
I mean, they're like, have you ever seen David Lynch's movie Grandmother? It's the one that's it reminds me of that. Like, these kids one day will be at Sundance with their own film. I just know it.
Yeah.
I also want to say that, you know, for the first impression I had as I was watching the film, or you know this thing, like, you know, on Facebook you have those clickbait things, like, where you go, we took a camera, and you'll never imagine what was behind this door, you know?
Yeah.
And it was like that, and I was very interested to, you know, to hear you talk about what you discovered. It's one thing to, you know, to talk to the those boys, you know, and meet them that way, but then, you know, when did you finally when did you first realize what was behind that door, what you had opened up?
I mean, it was a slow process. I've been working on this film for 5 years almost, and you know, I get information here and there, and you know, it was just like, as the trust built, it would, you know, come out, and I'd learn more. And at one point, I kind of realized that they, you know, I was their first friend. I realized I was their first friend.
Their first outside, first outside person.
Yeah, and that was like, that was huge, to be like, I'm the first person that you guys are having like some sort of relationship with. And, you know, I knew that there was more underneath there, but I was very patient with it because I just, it was a precious situation. And with this film, I just really wanted to keep it very neutral and get everybody's point of view and not have a heavy hand on like what my thoughts were on it. And I think that at the end of the day, it really worked out because the family, most of the family has seen the film, like the father and the mother have both seen the film, and everybody feels like it's a diplomatic portrait of their family. So
could you maybe talk a little more about the parents, because I know you got to know them as well. Before I saw it, I came into the film with kind of a different expectation because I had heard somewhere through the grapevine it described as a documentary version of the Greek film Dogtooth.
Yeah.
And which I found...
Not quite that far.
Which is what I kind of went in expecting. And so I was really surprised when I, you know, to watch it that's not at all... there's very little similarity other than the fact that they live in isolation.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little about the parents?
I just also want to say that, like, with the log line, it can be very sensationalized.
Sure.
I think this film is a story about a family that, you know, goes through some, you know, situations, and like every family, we can all relate. We can all see the different shades of the situation. So,
but you never saw it as an abusive or neglectful situation at all, right? Once you got to know them.
When I came into the situation, there was nothing that alarmed me. Mm-hmm. You know, beforehand, like maybe a few years before, maybe I would have had a different point of view. But you know, they've you know, gone through a lot, and they're on the other side of it now, and I am very close with the mother. I am friends with the father, and you know, we've all kind of looked at the situation in a very positive light, and you know, coming through the other side. And you know, the father isn't in denial about like what's happened in the past. So, yeah.
Well, you know, and I would also love to hear you talk about the editing process and how your relationship affected how you built that story. You know, you talk about, you know, who has seen the film and, you know, how they feel it's even-handed and what have you.
Yeah.
But what was in your mind as you're editing, you know, because you obviously became very close to them throughout the filming process.
Yeah. I mean, it was really hard, but I worked with Enat Sidi, who she did Dystopia and Jesus Camp, and we just were, our main goal is just to be as delicate as possible with it, and just to tell the story and really bring out the emotion and the heart of it. And you know, we didn't edit in like a traditional, like, okay, this happened, then this happened, this happened. We really built the emotion of the story, and kind of that brought out the structure in the end. So, yeah.
How did the boys react when they found out the film made it into Sundance?
I mean, we were all like losing our beep. We're like, is it real? I mean, this is their life, movies, and they're here and they're living and breathing it, and it's beautiful.
So they've all flown out to Sundance, have they?
Yeah, they're all out here.
They're running all over Park City. If you see six boys running in a pack.
Yeah, I mean, they're used to, I mean, in New York City already, people are like, "Oh, Wolfpack." People just know who they are.
Yeah,
they've gotten a little reputation.
I think we're getting the wrap up now. Actually, that's a shame because I have many more questions to ask. Mm-hmm. But Crystal Moselle, director of the Wolfpack, thank you very much for joining us. Are there any other screenings of the film coming up?
We're premiering tonight.
Oh, you're premiering tonight. Oh,
yeah.
Oh well, yeah. Head on down there. Any other screenings later in the week?
Tomorrow night at 11:30 p.m. Huh? And Wednesday in Salt Lake City.
Yeah. And what theater is the premiere at tonight?
It's at the Temple.
At the Temple. Yeah. Yes.
And also congratulations on the New York Times feature.
Thank you. There's a really great LA Times feature as well.
That's right. Huh? Cool.
Crystal, awesome. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Daily Buzz on KCPW. I am Dominic Miller, UK editor of We Got This Covered. I'm joined by John Wildman. You doing all right, John? So going okay thus far?
So far, we're hanging tight.
We are joined by Michael Madsen, the director of The Visit. Welcome, Michael. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
Now, could you just pitch the film to us as such? I mean, it's a pretty... it's a pretty crazy setup. Just give us a bit of outline as such.
What would happen if Earth was actually visited by extraterrestrial intelligent life? If somebody from beyond came here, what would actually happen? What would be the questions? Who would be the authorities who would actually try to encounter such a first contact? That's what the film is about.
It's a fascinating film. It's one of those things, you know, the cliche when someone says where they're like their mind was blown, but this is legitimately a mind-blowing film.
Agreed.
And also to prepare people, you know, that are, you know, going to go and sit their behinds in the theater to watch this movie. The movie, you actually approach the audience member as if they are the visiting alien, which I found fascinating. Mm-hmm. But as if you've walked into a room with these various experts and the various people that would be preparing us, mm-hmm. For this kind of event to mm-hmm. happen. Mm-hmm. Why did you choose that approach for this subject?
I think that I'm trying to make films which tries to explore or understand something about this reality, so to say. And I'm trying to create a perspective with that device of somebody coming from the outside, an outside viewpoint. And The Visit is a film about, yes, first contact, the implications of that. But it's also, of course, perhaps even more a film about ourselves, about how we envision the other, all our prejudices to watch the alien, so to say. So the perspective of a visitor from elsewhere coming for the first time to this world with no prior knowledge about this world is also cinematography, in terms of cinematography and so on, very, very interesting. And it can create a out of time and space, perhaps, perspective on this world, which I think is a healthy viewpoint to have sometimes.
Well, our assessment of how we think these things would play out are built on films like Independence Day or The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Mm. Especially the remake.
Yeah, exactly. and to have a scenario where you have, an official or an expert, explain to us as the alien, we need to build a barrier between the two of us initially because our biology may hurt you and your biology may hurt us.
Yeah.
That's nothing that Hollywood movies ever, really care about because they just want the scares
and
what have you. Or even an explanation or an attempt at an explanation as to why we need information from you as the alien to prepare society for the fact that you're here,
yes.
for media.
Yes.
I found that very, very interesting. Mm-hmm. And I'm also curious to hear, as a filmmaker, how you placed weight on each one of those aspects, because I think it's, you know, you could make a miniseries on this,
yeah,
frankly.
Yeah, the film is made without any script. I just wanted these real experts and these real, you can say, bodies like the United Nations Office for Outer Space Affairs, etc., to enter the actual situation. So now imagine you are sitting in front of a entity from elsewhere. It understands English. It's intelligent. It has self-consciousness and so on. What would you actually do? So instead of sort of perhaps crafting a film which would then in many ways just be based on the scenarios that we know from popular culture and Hollywood Independence Day and so on, because it is as if the world has been in a training camp for 100 years for this to happen in a way. So it's in our consciousness. Is there life out there? I think that's a basic human question. But I made the film just trying to follow in extremis what would be the real implications, what would be the actual concerns. And yes, one of the concerns that are very real is the prospect of panic, because if something unknown enters this world, then I think we are ending up in the dead angle of Western self-understanding, which is to be in control.
It's almost, it's what was it, John Landis described it as the foundation of all great horror is that fear of the unknown.
Yes.
And like, would you almost see the idea, an unknown entity arriving on Earth as the setup for something truly horrific then? Like,
I think the truly horrific in The Visit is the suspicion that what is truly alien here is something resting within ourselves, within us human beings. Because that is what would be the real challenge for such an encounter, is what is truly a human being. That is what we would have to try to explain. And in The Visit, this seems to be slightly difficult.
I also want to talk about the fact that, and because, you know, when an audience member is approaching something like this, I think there's a preconceived notion that they're going to have a bunch of talking heads.
Yeah.
And it's just one person sitting at a table versus another person sitting at a table. But you do a wonderful job of illustrating, you know, the preparation, showing someone, you know, doing that investigation or exploration. And can you talk about a little bit about how you chose to approach that?
I think the problem about first encounter is, I think the only thing to say for certain about this event is that it's beyond our imagination and perhaps beyond what we can fathom in a way. So the device of crafting the film as seen from the alien, that allowed me to enter this world in a way with some different glasses. And it was a very difficult film to make, because this film, its visuality, is meant to transcend itself and to go beyond just beautiful images. It was a very difficult film to make. It took, instead of 20 weeks, took 40 weeks, because for this film, it has to be edited on a different level than just info level. It works on a different level if it works. I'm not, I mean, it's difficult for me to say as a director, but after all, it's here. And I can also put it in a different way. Where does a film really take place? I think a film really takes place inside the imagination of the spectator. So that's what I've been trying to craft. But a spectator that is somehow put in the shoes of an alien visitor.
Well, speaking of, you know, as someone who's you know, coming into a new situation as someone from the outside, this is your first Sundance. You just got here. Can you draw any parallels from you being at Sundance versus the alien approaching us in the film?
Well, I think that I'll enjoy the an American audience, and of course I'm looking forward to the reactions, because this is tonight in Prospector Theatre at 8:30. This is first contact between the film and any audience, and I'm very curious about how that goes down, so to say. What will people see in this film?
Well, I think it's a discussion point movie. I think it's one of those films, and I think every filmmaker hopes for this, that that it'll be something that people will be chewing on in the lobby, you know, and then as they adhere, going back to their condos after the film. So I think you're going to be in for some very interesting Q&As.
Thank you very much.
Definitely. It's a real talking point. Michael Madsen is the director of The Visit. It is screening tonight at 8:30 at what theater did
Prospector.
You say? At the Prospector. It's one hell of a trip. Michael, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And if you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Daily Buzz from the 2015 Sundance Film Festival on KCPW. I'm Dominic Mill. I am joined by my co-host, James Faust, and our producer, Irene Cho. You doing all right, Irene?
I'm doing great.
You're getting some words in for once. We are also joined by Liz Garbus, the director of What Happened to Miss Simone, which premiered a couple of nights ago. How are you doing, Liz?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
James, Irene, which one of you wants to go from the off? James, fire away.
I'll go. Big fan.
Thank
Love
you.
Love your work.
Thank you.
You're practically super prolific.
Okay, I'll take it as a compliment.
Walking into this, I had a chance to see the opening night, and that was one of the most powerful opening nights I've ever seen.
Oh yeah, baby, thank you.
That was great. What you've accomplished. When I love documentaries, because sometimes you go into something knowing something, and you're like, oh wow, I want to know more, or you go into something not knowing. I thought I knew Nina Simone.
Yeah.
I thought I knew that person's work.
Yeah.
What I saw in your film was gut-wrenching and a little, it brought some things to light that made sense, especially when we got into the bipolar thing. So going into this film, what did you know about Nina Simone?
You know, what I knew about Nina Simone was that she was awesome. And, you know, when my husband, my now husband, first came over, you know, to my apartment and I was making him dinner and stuff, you know, what I put on to impress him, it was Nina Simone. And it really worked. It totally worked. But that was what I knew. I knew her music. Yeah. I did not know the woman. So when when I got approached, it came from the estate, you know, that her daughter was finally ready. You know, so many people over the years had approached them. They wanted to do something on Nina, and there are so many people so protective of her legacy. So you can understand, you know, she's a complicated woman. In the wrong hands, you could make her look like a monster. You know, like she had some real dark shit in her life. Am I allowed to curse? No. Okay, sorry. All right, I just did anyway. All right. So she had some dark stuff in her life, and so they were very protective, you know. And at some point, I think there are a variety of forces out in the world that made them decide they were ready to allow the story to be told and let go. You know, allow the story to be told and not exert control over it. Because I think when that happens, you don't get really, you know, filmmakers don't really want to work when they don't have final cut, you know. So I think they were finally ready to let that happen. And then so I said, somebody called me and they said, are you interested? And I said, look, I love the music. Let me find out more about the life. And I picked up Nina Simone's autobiography and I was like, I read it in like 2 hours. I was like, oh my God, can I get this job? You know, it was just like, you know, so fierce. I mean, I knew she was an activist, but I didn't know she left it all on the mat like that. You know, I knew, you know, one suspects she had troubles in her life and in her family, but I didn't, you know, the dynamic between her and her husband, and of course her own internal demons and living all your life with undiagnosed mental illness and everyone just thinking you're a monster at times and being overcome. And she wouldn't even remember the rages, you know, after they would come over her. And then this mania, you know, she would also have these manic episodes, which would be, you know, sexual or they would be filled with anger. And, you know, to live like that and not have any understanding, you know, that's a lot of suffering.
I wanted to echo James. I was also at opening night, and I really want to applaud you as a female director, as a documentary storyteller. I think you set the tone for the festival, and you raised the bar really high. I, too, was moved by Nina Simone. I didn't realize until I heard the music in the film how much of her music I had really grown up with. It was very... it was so moving. I was weeping throughout the entire film, and I really think that a lot of our listeners can identify with her background, her story, her role as a mother, her role as an activist,
that's right, yeah.
and as a songwriter, you know, and you did an amazing job.
Yeah, like who knew, who, like her, you know, her lists as a mom were like I have the same lists, you know, I have kids, like, you know, and that struggle of being a working mother, you know, I relate, you know, it's a very basic feminist struggle, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And she, you know, and so yeah, she's like deeply relatable on different levels than I had expected when I started the film. Yeah.
Well, what was striking to me, one, I didn't know she had a husband. I felt weird, like, oh man, I don't know anything about her.
It's
one of those things. But and then that relationship was so volatile, and I don't know, indicative of a lot of other. Sort of music, entertainment relationship.
Yeah, like why do you think everyone knows Ike and Tina, but nobody knows Nina and Andy? What do you think? Why?
I don't know.
Because they were more private? Like, did the others... I don't know.
And you know, it's fun. And it's really... I guess... I think her activism was more overshadowing that other relationship.
That's right, yeah.
Because she was out there for other different things, whereas right. Tina and Ike were just making music.
Yeah. I guess so, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I also think that I understand that Nina had a story to tell, but she didn't necessarily want to be on a pedestal to tell it.
Right.
So she told through her lyrics, you know, the fact that she did popular music. I mean, I think that was one of the items of controversy between her husband and her, that she wasn't doing the types of shows that Gladys Knight was doing
or that Aretha Franklin was doing. Yeah, yeah.
But she felt so compelled with that Mississippi Got Damned. With that story, when she wrote that song after the... After the incident in Birmingham, Alabama, and that she didn't care about how popular her music was, but she felt it was important for that generation to know the story to know the context. I mean, she's a historical figure in that sense, and how timely, and I'm sure, James, you're going to touch on this, but how timely for that to come out now, and listening to her story through your eyes, how much has not changed.
Well, that's right.
That's what I was most...
Well,
appalled by.
There's this interview with Nina in the 1980s where she's being interviewed by another African-American woman and for Essence. And they say to her, how far have we come with civil rights? And Nina looks at her like she's an idiot, you know, and she just gives her that Nina Simone look. And she's like, there are no civil rights. And then she says her songs aren't relevant anymore. And how painful is that statement? And, you know, I think we know they're so relevant today, but how do we make them relevant? You know, how do we bring her voice? You know, I think that's why John Legend came out. You know, I think it's about bringing back that kind of spirit. Of course, there are so many wonderful artists today who are political. I'm not trying to say there are no Nina Simones, but, you know, I don't know. She has a real place today.
What's kind of part what her struggle was as well, like wanting to be on those Ed Sullivan shows, or wanting to be on those shows back then because she had something to say. And having a point, and having a platform, and I'd like to be on those because I bet she wanted to say the things when she was in those concerts and riling up a lot of the choir, if you will, going hey, but tell people that aren't listening.
Yeah,
and I think and that's why John Legend coming out, and I think there is a place. I think there are civil rights. It's just they're just quieter, and it's just not working as hard as it once did.
For our listeners, maybe you guys can reference what John Legend was doing at the opening night, because I think that would give some context.
That John Legend guy.
Who is this John Legend?
Oh, you were talking about so after the screening that night, we were treated to a special Academy Award nominee, Grammy winning John Legend came out and sang, I think, three songs from Nina. It was... Wow. And not only was the songs were great, the lighting was good, the screen went up.
It was poignant.
It was like... We took video. I'll post it on my Facebook later.
Oh, good, because I couldn't see anything.
No.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure I'll find it online somewhere because I was backstage, but yeah.
Oh, well, he did. What was the last song you did that she recorded?
Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood.
Yeah, her cover of
somebody else.
It was just strong. I mean, there were two people next to me weeping, and I was thinking,
I'd like to jump in and ask you a little bit about how it was like working with her daughter, because you could tell that she was still struggling a lot with her relationship with her mother and the significance of her mother's role in the 60s and in activism and in American history. But I felt that she really made a huge step by telling that story at her own expense so that other people could benefit. I'm curious how that was.
You know, I think Lisa, she's someone, you know, she's in a process, right? Like she grew up with those two parents, right? And, you know, and if you haven't seen the film, you know, you might know that Nina was a temperamental individual, a brilliant temperament, but, you know, also Nina's husband, Lisa's father, was no cakewalk. And he was quite brutal. And, you know, there was a lot of domestic violence in that household. And so Lisa spent a long time, you know, talking, thinking, recovering, healing. And she's, you know, she's a really spiritual person. And, you know, the emails I get from her now, you know, we did have the opportunity to show her the film before it went public, you know, which was the right thing to do. And, you know, so she said, you know, Mommy, I did Mommy proud. Like, I'm okay. She gave me no notes. She gave me no criticism. She gave me love. She was just like, Namaste. I bless you. We are, you know, I've done my thing. I can move on in my life. I'm going to focus on my career now. I'm moving forward. And who could expect that? Like, I don't think I could look at myself, talk about my family, and not be like, dudes, can you just, like, you know, like that level of, like, peace and zenness and also trust in me as a filmmaker is beautiful. It's so beautiful. And with someone like Nina Simone, and let's not forget, I'm also a white woman, you know, so there took a leap and, like, trusting me and, like, we, you know, talking about that, talking through that. And I don't think you have to be a white woman to make a white... I don't think you have to be a white person to make a film about a white person or a black person to make a film about a black person, but you don't want to, like, pretend like that's not something that we all need to talk about. And, you know, we had those conversations, and I just... Her trust in me was just, you know, beautiful. I'm not sure if I were her, I could let go of my family story as easily. And mine is not nearly as exciting and dramatic as hers.
Is there anything... document how much footage did you have of this thing at the end of the day?
Well, we had, as you know, we went all over the earth to find audio tapes of Nina telling her story, and we must have had 70 or 80 hours of Nina talking.
Wow. Her talking.
And that's just Nina talking. And then we had, you know, a lot of tens and dozens and hours of other people talking. And then we had the beautiful, we had the concert footage, and then we had the Nina interview footage. So there was a lot. And the stills, you know, the amount of stills we had, it was embarrassment of riches. It was wonderful.
So looking back, you finished the film. Is there something when you're watching again, or maybe feeling our audience reaction, thinking, you know what, I should have included this part near, because I honestly, it's about 100 minutes, 103.
103, yeah.
Yeah, 103. I was thinking, I could actually use about 25 more minutes.
Oh, yeah, me too. Will you call Netflix out?
I will. In that second life, when she goes from Liberia to the end
Paris,
of her life,
yeah.
That whole part, I would love to go, I want more of this. These other guys that are coming in that are taking care of her.
Yeah,
and I kept thinking there was more there.
Yeah.
And
then going, oh, yeah, there's so much more.
You could do the sequel. This is what happened, Miss Simone.
Yeah.
Netflix,
no, I mean,
I'll
tell you one thing that I regret. One thing that's not in there, and it's like you just have to make these choices. But I know you all know her song For Women.
Yes.
And, you know, that is one song that is just so brilliant. And, you know, but I hope people who don't know Nina Simone, they'll watch this film and then they'll find that song. Yeah. You know, they'll find that song. So
Liz Garbus is the director of What Happened, Miss Simone. It went down a treat as the opening night documentary at the festival this year. Liz, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, and if you haven't checked it out yet, we do have 3 more screenings coming up this week.
Good plug. Thanks, Liz.
Thanks.
Wrapping up today's edition of The Daily Buzz, I'm Dominic Mill. We want to thank KCPW, Merrill Trailscape, Pop Art Snacks, Boxed Water, Cloud Electronics, Angry Porcupine, Skull Candy, Cotopaxi, Najafam Lockwood, and David Lockwood, The Market at Park City, You Offend Me, You Offend My Family, Beyond Right and Wrong, and the show's producer is the irascible, irrepressible Irene Cho. I'm Dominic Mill, with my co-hosts John Wildman, James Faust, Anderson Lay, and Kim Voyner. John, who have we got on tomorrow?
We've got Take Me to the River.
James?
Yeah, we're going to be speaking with the founders of Slam Dance.
Anderson?
We're going to talk to the director of The Mask We Live In.
Kim?
And also the director of a wonderful film called Advantageous.
And I am going to be talking to the director of the magnificent Glassland. That does it for the Daily Buzz today. Thanks for listening.